This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamoto, MPR. If you're a fan of MPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Grant Hidfield
and Jane Bolton.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Now, Grant, your family has a very long history in New Zealand, I believe.
Yes, Stuart, my great-great-great-grandfather arrived on the 3rd of August 1823, and that was Henry Williams, who, to many will understand, Henry Williams was given the unenviable task of translating the treaty overnight when that happened.
So now, that was translated from English to Maori or Maori to English?
English to Maori.
Okay.
And look, it's a topic for another debate,
yes, absolutely.
You know, because there's obviously some controversy around that.
Yep.
But anyhow, that was Henry Williams. My great-great-grandfather, Bishop Octavius Hadfield, goodness me, well, he came from obviously the Isle of Wight in the UK. Couldn't be ordained in the UK because he didn't have a degree, and he ended up being ordained in Sydney by Bishop Broughton, the Bishop of Australia, before he came to the Bay of Islands.
Because their standards are different?
Well, you had to have a degree back in the old days, in the UK.
But not in Australia.
That's right, yeah.
Okay.
And so Octavius ended up coming to Paihia, and on January 1839 he actually became the first priest to be ordained in New Zealand. So that was Octavius, and he also went on to become Bishop of Wellington and Anglican Primate of New Zealand, and you know, very strong. He based himself on the Kapiti Coast, which is where all my family come from.
Didn't he marry one of the
Williams? Yes, he did. He married Henry Williams' daughter, Kate.
That's right. I'm just reading about
so
it.
Kate Hadfield, and an incredible woman in her own right.
Yes.
In fact, she walked from the Bay of Islands to Otaki with my great-grandfather, Henry Williams, when he was a little toddler. And I think she was the first white woman to have a crack at that, you know. It's quite interesting. There's lots of stories and lots of information available, actually, on the web. If you go searching, and on Kate as well.
So you search for the names of...
Henry Williams, Octavius Hadfield,
And Kate
Hadfield.
Kate Hadfield, okay.
Yep. And the bishop then, of course, retired to Martin. First property he ever owned in his life was when he retired, and he bought a place that's actually called Edale in Martin, which is where the old folks' home is now.
Okay.
And he is buried, along with Kate, out at the little church at Tutatotra, on the Marshalls, you know, where the Marshalls' property is. And the Marshalls are also related, because the Marshalls married one of the bishop's daughters as well. So it's a small world that we live in, New Zealand.
Yeah.
And then my great-grandfather, Henry Hadfield, he unfortunately died quite young, but he also he did a few things. He went banking in the Hawke's Bay, but he eventually bought land in Paraparaumu. And he ended up being a licensed interpreter in the Houses of Parliament, and then on in the Houses of the House of Representatives.
Maori.
Yeah, he was Maori interpreter. Yes. Yeah, in the House.
So would he have grown up speaking Maori?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, he would have. Okay. Yeah, because the bishop, Octavius, was considered an expert in the language and also Maori affairs, and of course. The bishop had actually, strangely enough, and I've got a letter that was written on behalf of Te Rauparaha in 1848 to the bishop when he was in Wellington convalescing, because he was quite sickly for a while.
You've got the letter?
Yeah, I've got the letter, yeah.
Oh, right.
And it just proves what a close relationship that Octavius is a what we in the family call a skinny white fellow, you know, and old Te Rapraha, who was, you know, considered to be a bit of a fearsome warrior.
Yeah.
They had a good relationship, and of course the bishop had a good relationship with Te Rapraha's son, Tamihana Te Rapraha, as well. Mm. But going back to Henry, he farmed and also a Maori interpreter. He died when he was 57, quite young, and he'd been actually sailed to the UK to get treatment. He had cancer of the eye, and he sailed trying to get treatment in the UK. And he came back and he died not long after he returned, age 57, and left my great-grandmother and four young children, the eldest of which was my grandfather, who was 10 years old when his father died. So he then farmed the property.
So the oldest was 10 years old when his father died at 57?
Yep, married late.
Okay.
Yep. I'm pretty sure he was 10 years old. My siblings might correct me, but they're not here to do it, so that's fine. So, yes, interestingly enough, my grandfather, as soon as he was able, you know, then took over the farm and worked his way through the Depression and through the war years. Hell of a struggle for him. But he came out the other side. And my dad, who was at Whanganui Collegiate at the time, got pulled out of school because my grandfather couldn't get any labour on the farm. So then dad farmed as well. But then my father also had quite an extensive career in local government as well as being a farmer. Mm-hmm. And he served many years on the Hutt County Council. As Paraparaumu was part of what was considered the Hutt County, which, and you know, it was just another one of the balls ups, I suppose you might say, of local government.
So where was the farm?
Lindale, Paraparaumu, on the main road as you go to Perth.
That is the Lindale that was...
There were Lindale that was built, dead built, in the 80s, yeah. So that was the family land.
The one that had all the, tourist attractions and shops and everything.
Cavity cheeses.
Is it still going like that?
Oh, look, it's pretty quiet now there, I think, you know. You know, it's quite interesting.
It was noted for one time. A good place to stop and take children.
Well, and of course now the expressway's through and there's no traffic on the main road.
Yeah.
So look, Dad got into... he elected to the Hutt County in 1965 and he served as a councillor on the Hutt County till 73. So... eight odd years. Mm. And when Kapiti Borough was formed, he became the first elected mayor. He did two terms then and then spent a bit of time on the local government commission until the change of government in 1984 because they were all political appointees.
Yeah.
And when the Labour, the Longy government came in, the old man and his two colleagues got booted and Brian Elwood, I think, became the local commissioner, local government commissioner. So there was a little bit of, you know, like there's some quite significant family history, not only, you know... In shaping the, you know, the society, early New Zealand society, but you know, very strong on the Kapiti Coast. But the bishop's influence was, you know, far and wide. I not spent too much of my life on the Kapiti Coast. The rest of my family are still reside on the coast. But late 70s, we shifted off and I worked up the Whangahu Valley on a farm after I'd spent a bit of time in publishing after I left school.
So you deliberately wanted to leave the area or you...
Well, not really. It was sort of, you know, like I'd typical bugger if I know what I'm going to do when I leave school. So I'd worked for a publishing company. And then, you know, like all things, when you get a little bit older, I think, well... You know, we've all been brought up on the land, and the, say what you like. If you have an affinity with the land, it never goes away. So I worked at home for a bit, and then I shot off to up the Whangahu Valley with my wife and young daughter, and my son was born in Whanganui. And then we bought in 1980, I think, bought a farm out of Taihape at Matarua. Or to be precise, at the top of the Tirirakawa. So we were there, and of course the change of government in 1984 and the abolition of subsidies and all those things that happened in farming was pretty gruesome for highly indebted young farmers in the mid to late 80s. And by 1989, I'd done my time, you know, put my hands up and surrendered.
Yeah, the economic thinking with that was, well, the efficient ones will survive and the inefficient won't. But what meant was those who had been investing or had indebtedness because of recent purchases were struggling.
Well, I think actually that was probably slightly a flawed view, Stuart. At the end of the day, those that had no debt or little debt survived, and those that were highly indebted were actually quite buggered. Yeah. And a lot of, I guess, my generation that had bought in and had the, you know, things changed. You know, you just couldn't make it work. It was it was not economically viable.
Well, it was a huge intake. What were the interest rates at that stage?
Well, look, I ended up paying 17.5% on my rural bank loan, 26.5% on my overdraft. And because the overdraft wasn't big enough, I think I might have topped out at 32.5% penalty overdraft. So it was pretty rugged.
We were 21, I think. 21.
Yeah.
It was a lot of money to be paying out.
Yeah. So
it shows how politicians can be out of touch, because the sort of terminology was we cutting away the dead wood and we'll be left with a lean, efficient economy.
We probably shouldn't debate that topic, you know.
About politicians, maybe not.
Well, but look, at the end of
I do want to ask, though, because you've given a lot about your family background. Now, for you, you probably just take it for granted, but I would have thought a background such as that would really shape how you see yourself in the country and your position and role or identity here.
It's quite interesting, because I think it's probably more so for my brothers and sister who are on the Kapiti Coast. But regardless of that fact, yes, you're right. It's a history that we've been brought up with. Hmm. And I guess in that regard, it's second nature to us. Yeah. And so, you know, we've been, it's pretty hard to actually define in a way, but, you know, we've been brought up to, one, understand the family history, but also to respect it and to be proud of it, you know, of which we are. And of course, I think the big regret that probably we have is that we never questioned my grandfather or my father enough before they departed this world.
That's the standard line with oral history recording.
It's a standard line.
Why?
Having said that, we're very lucky that we do have a lot of written correspondence. Hmm. So certainly from the bishop, from Octavius. We've currently got a learned gentleman. Dr. the Reverend Bruce Patrick is currently transcribing a lot of the letters and stuff that my late father gave me just before he died. Never been published before, so we're really looking forward to actually getting a transcript of not only what the bishop wrote, but Jane, what Kate, who got an awful lot of letters that Kate wrote, and she was a woman of, in our view, of significance. And the bishop always said, actually, like any good bloke, he put his hand up and said, you know, I wouldn't have achieved this without Kate, you know. And he often, pushed, I guess, a lot of the praise onto Kate, because she, by all accounts, you know, was an incredible woman. Interestingly, though, as a man of the church and a man of devout faith, the bishop actually, probably by default, ended up being quite political. Yeah. And there's a whole lot of stuff available. He got called before the before Parliament. And look, I haven't got that stuff with me, but there's a list of questions that have been we got from Hansard, and the bishop was because he was considered a pest. And because, you know, Archdeacon Henry Williams and Bishop Hadfield were both, they both travelled this part of the country in terms of getting you know, iwi to sign up to the treaty. Mm. And, you know, like I know, for instance, that the two of them witnessed Ngāti Apa signing the treaty, for instance. So when the treaty was signed, the bishop was the first to go into bat for, you know, against the Crown, against the New Zealand Company, who didn't like him, where the treaty had been clearly breached.
Okay.
And Taranaki Land Wars is a prime example of that.
Okay, because I was going to say, you're because of your family background, that your family and the Maori must have almost a unique relationship.
Well, yes, I think on the Kapiti Coast that's actually probably the case, although you know, you can never assume anything, Stuart. And there's been a little bit of tension at times between, my understanding is the bishop wouldn't allow Te Rāpiraha to be buried in the little church at Rangiatea, at Aitaki, because he hadn't been christened. You know, I think that caused a little bit of friction. On the whole, I think there is mutual respect, I think is probably the best way to describe it. Mm-hmm. So the bishop was actually quite political as well, and he's often considered to have been probably the most political churchman, influential political churchman that New Zealand's ever seen. Before he died, the old bugger got a whole lot of his political papers and writings and burnt them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for those of us in the family now, we're thinking, oh, wouldn't that be fascinating to actually... Yeah. But he wanted to be remembered as a man of his faith, not a man of politics, you know. And, well, clearly that's, you know, it's just the way it was.
There'd be a lot existing elsewhere anyway.
There's a lot. The Alexander Turnbull have got stuff. Wellington Public Library have actually got quite a bit of the bishop's correspondence as well. Mm. And then we've got a whole dollop more that's currently being transcribed. And then, of course, we've got to decide what we're going to do with it.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. But there is another book on the bishop pending from Dr. Bruce Patrick, and he believes that the biographies written on the bishop to date have grossly understated his achievements. So, you know, as a family, we're quite looking forward to his research.
Yeah.
And he's been back to England to the CMS, and he's got all of the bishop's writings back to the CMS from New Zealand. It's just fantastic. So, we're still learning about this stuff as well.
Yeah,
right. And it's just unfortunate that Dad's not here or my grandfather. Mm. Although, you know, my grandfather was pretty young, you know, when his father died, as I've said. Yeah. But, we're lucky that we've got a lot of written and documented history, you know, and that's quite significant. But, look, that's the family.
Yeah.
And when I finished up and when I left the farm in Taiepi in 1989, we moved to the Manawatū in 1989, been here since, you know. So both my children live here. It's been home to me since 1989. So
what have you done in that time? When did you become involved with Ian?
Our revered MP, MP for Rangitiki, Ian McKelvey. Well, I went to school with Ian. We went to Huntley and Collegiate together, so have known him for a long time. And I've been his campaign chair for all my failings for the last couple of elections. So that's, I've known Ian for a long time, and actually our grandparents were mates, and I think used to have the odd dram at Taupo, you know. So, that's how I got...
We could probably revisit this, but there's one area that I've not yet been able to record people on, and that's their experience as farmers through all the changes in 1984 and the financial thing in 1987.
Yeah, well, look, I'm happy to touch on that.
Yeah.
Significantly difficult time, and
you grew up with the idea of farming and supplement. You were,
well, eventually I got to the point. Yeah,
supplementary minimum prices were a key aspect.
Yep, all there. And look, at the end of the day, you know, there's not much point debating the fact that getting rid of subsidies was the right thing to do. Yeah. I think the thing that David Longy didn't go along with. I don't think he totally agreed with Roger Douglas, and that was clear. But, you know, the sadness I have about it is not so much what happened personally, you know, but it did have an impact. But, you know, when I looked at that period of time which saw the decimation of rural New Zealand, rural depopulation, significant rural suicide, which has, you know, been an ongoing issue, to be honest, and I sort of, you know, got into that a little bit in my FarmSafe years, which I guess we'll touch on.
Yeah, sure.
But you know, it's like everything, you know, governments come and governments go. So the overall, in my view, the overall outcome of actually getting rid of subsidies was you know, was the right direction to travel.
Yeah.
But it had such a huge impact on what I call the core values of New Zealand society.
From one structure to another.
Yeah, well, I think so. That's the difference. Yeah, I think
so. Fully adjusted to a situation with no subsidies.
Bang, was overnight, you know. So you ended up getting, you know, like for Thai Happy, you know, I can remember in the early 80s, a forward store lamb would, you know, sold down on the fielding sale yards, would be $20-22. And after 1984 and subsidies going, you're lucky if we get $5, you know. And and then, of course, the interest rates went from 7.5 to 17.5, you know. Yes. So
now, it was part of the problem, though, that with the subsidies, they were supporting certain sorts of farming and hence inevitably discouraging others. And if the subsidies were out of kilter with world markets, production was going wrong. So then there was a lot of talk about diversification. Did you try to diversify?
Well, no, actually, no. The answer is no, because it was interesting. My grandfather was a little bit entrepreneurial, and he had some he had some interesting encounters with the Ministry of Ag or whatever they called it back in those days. And it was when superphosphate was first on the scene. My grandfather had done fertilizer trials on the flats on the farm at Paraparaumu. And he found that actually on that country, basic slag gave him the best result. And the boffins heard that he had all of this, you know, he'd done all of this stuff and had some data, so they came out. The minute they knew that that superphosphate wasn't his preferred choice, they weren't interested. But the interesting thing is that my grandfather always said when people asked him during the Depression and everything else, are you going to diversify? And he said, yes, I am going to diversify. And they used to say, what are you going to do, Gordon? And he told us a story. I'm going to farm sheep and cattle. Mm-hmm. He said, that's what you're doing now. Correct, he said. So diversification isn't always the answer. And I think my grandfather was a good example of that. But there's nothing you can do on Taihebe Hill Country apart from sheep and cattle.
Well, I was an economist, and when I was asked about that, I said, well, it doesn't mean that all farmers have to diversify by doing other things. You need maybe just a small proportion to switch to something else. So you've got smaller supply of say, sheep meat, so the price goes up and you're producing something.
Well, it wasn't only, you know, like there were supplementary minimum payments, you know, like, so wool was, you know, had a base price and it was topped up, same with lamb, per kilo of lamb. Mm. But there were also, in budgets, I recall, you know, everybody got 50 cents for a breeding ewe, or you might have got $2 for a breeding cow as a, you know, as a handout. Well, and that was all in Rob Muldoon's day, you know, So, you know, look, some people survived the 80s, some people didn't. It cost some people their lives. It cost a lot of people, an awful lot in terms of personal anguish.
So they didn't see any warning signs. I mean, even like, say, with Britain going into the EU and the implications there, a lot of these things were signaled for a long time.
But, well, I think, I mean, you know, things have changed an awful lot now. I think, you know, I mean, farming's actually quite a precise science now compared to what it used to be. You know, if you think of the technology advances since the early 80s, the late 70s, and also I think, you know, with the way communication, the ability to communicate has significantly developed from what it was. What did we used to do? We used to turn on the TV and listen to the news or read the newspaper, you know, and
black and white. And
that was about it.
Yeah.
So, you know, were we a little bit ignorant on what's happening on a global scene? Possibly we were. Yeah. And, of course, today it's, which isn't always a good thing, but it's so much easier to be informed.
Yeah.
Or actually,
either misinformed.
or misinformed, you're dead right, you know, or ill-informed, or all of the above. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I found that quite an interesting time. I learned a lot about myself during that time. It was a very, very difficult time, you know, personally for my ex-wife and I, and as a family.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people, I think, suffered, you know, the same degree of anguish. And, of course, back in those days, it wasn't a bloke sort of thing to do to look for any sort of help. In fact, I wasn't quite sure if I needed help or not. I'm sure I did. Mm. But, you know, when you get into a bit of a black hole, sometimes it's pretty hard to get out of it. And, you know, for me, that journey started when I actually realised there was no future. You know, you just can't keep going backwards. And but more than anything, I couldn't see a future for my children. And so that really, you know, and we sold that farm probably for half what we paid for it.
So the farm you're on just was, I suppose was viable at half the price, but not at the price you paid.
Well, anything's viable at a price.
Yeah.
Well, look, the next sale price of that farm was four times what I sold it for.
Yeah. How much later? When it was sold after?
Jane, look. You know, I sold in 1989, and look, I honestly don't know when the next sale was.
How big was the farm?
600 acres.
Oh, yeah,
Reasonably steep. Had a beautiful bit of native bush up the top, quite high, just over 3,000 feet at the top. Got a bit of snow, you know, got a bit hardy. And I think the worst year we had 5 snowfalls between Easter and Labour weekend.
So it wouldn't make any difference. Had it been bigger, it wouldn't make any difference.
No, I think, you know, we were buggered. Right? And, you know, you can only go backwards.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I've never tried to ride a bicycle backwards, but even walking backwards is bloody hard. And quite frankly, we were just going backwards at a great rate of knots, and you've sometimes got to pull the plug.
You do.
Yep. So we did, and let the water out of the sink, and and then moved on, you know. So,
good,
yeah, it's an interesting time, but
Is that what led you into the sort of health and safety area?
Well, no. Funnily enough, no. Look, as I said earlier, I think a passion for rural New Zealand is something that you either have or you don't. I grew up in it, and it's always, you know, been something very dear to my heart, I guess. And so when I left the farm, I went back and I worked for Reed Publishing, which was actually interesting, it was called Reed, but it had nothing to do with the old AH and AW Reed, who were the great, you know. So Reed was an English company, actually, Reed Elsevier, I think it was called. But look, you know, what the hell does a broken down ex-cocky do when you've walked off the farm and things are a bit crappy in life, you know? So I got a job as a representative for Reed Publishing, the lower half of the North Island. And sort of, you know, that got me through the next 5 or 6 years of my life as I, you know, readjusted to a different life.
So what sort of work was that? A rep? So you go around the bookshops?
Whoever would, not only bookshops, actually, you know, like we used to, you know, Reed published a broad range of stuff. Mm. And, you know, there were beautiful New Zealand publications. They were on, like, the Inter-Island line. They'd go anywhere, you know, not just bookshops.
Did you know what you were talking about?
I've often been accused, Jane, that the fact that if I don't know what I'm talking about, I just make it up. And I suppose I probably should deny that, seeing somebody's recording me. But the answer is yes. You know, look, I am a great reader, and I did read a lot of what was being peddled. But look, it was a bit of fun. And, you know, that took me away. I was travelling a lot for 5.5 years. Mm. And when the position at the Manawatu Agricultural and Pastoral Association came up, I thought, bloody ripper is what I thought. You know, I can get back into dealing with
Agricultural and Pastoral Association. That's the ANP show.
ANP, yep, ANP show. A&P. And so the opportunity to get back in and mingle with rural folk again was actually quite appealing to me. You know, and so I did that.
What did you do?
Well, I managed the organisation for the association, which of course is an association of volunteers.
Yeah. And that was for the showgrounds.
Yes, yep. So we did, I think I did 7 shows. Colin Dyer was the manager of the showgrounds at the time, that's right. And and we did 2 rural shows under my tenure. And then 2002,
So what was your impression? They were good fun, they were massive, they were...
Well, actually, it was changing times as well. Interestingly enough, you know, because look, at the end of the day, you know, as we discussed earlier, you know, technology changes, and if you look at some of the, you know, the old style of farmers showing sheep and cattle, things came along like Breedingworth, you know, and it wasn't just a visual appraisal that made that lamb good or that bull good. There was a whole lot of data that came along with it as well. And so the whole idea of showing as it was traditionally, changed. And I think, and look, to be brutally honest, the best part of the AMP show was probably the stock cars in the evening and the fireworks, you know. Yes.
And also there was all the, you get the alpacas and all that.
They came in later. I remember once, one of the raw shows we ran, we had pigs. They wanted guy from Ashurst, Paul Peck. And so Paul was very good, and he organised a whole lot of pigs, and we thought, where are we going to put them? So in the old grandstand, there was, above the ref's room, there was that, you could walk up into an area. Yes. It was normally... Yeah. It was actually normally covered in pigeon shit, to be honest. Yeah. But anyhow, we put pigs up there. Well, man, did that make a mess, you know. But look, you know, it's quite good fun. And my view was that anything you can do to bring country and town together is hugely important for communities, you know, like this. And even Palmerston North, but you know, hugely so for the Manawatu district, which of course, you know, relies on a rural economy for its well-being.
But it moved to Fielding then, didn't it?
Well, yes. The ANP Association used to own the showgrounds. And so their interest in that was protected by the Palmerston North Showgrounds Act 1974 or whatever it was. And when I think the city came to the point where they'd had enough of, you know, of horse dung and sheep crap and whatever through the stadiums on the fields, they put their hands up and there were discussions just before I actually left in the early 2000s, 2000, 2001, around whether or not, you know, the rural show would be better off at Manfield rather than in the showgrounds or arena, as they call it. I can't get showgrounds out of my head, to be honest. I still call it the showgrounds. And so, you know, there was an agreement come to the city and the district council in terms of the shift. Okay. And I guess there was some dollars involved, but at that point in time, I wasn't privy to that. So, yes, that changed over, and they both the Fielding ANP now and the Manawatu ANP Association, because it's actually the Manawatu and West Coast, ANP Association, are both based in at Manfield, and for the life of me, I can't understand why they don't get together. But anyhow, I'm past all that.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website. And a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.